This is the Packet Pushers podcast and another episode in our Future of Networking series. The idea behind a Future of Networking is that we need to recognize that 30 years of technical debt has been gathering dust and cruft. And there's a pile of unpaid technical debt, and we need to work out if the creditors are coming to collect this quarter or in a few years' time. The goal of the Future of Networking series is to try and dig into the long-term viability of networking. Is what we're doing today the only way out? Are we going to continue to iterate onto it, or are there going to be jumps? And we go out and find industry luminaries, people who either built the internet or building the future of the internet, and get them to just talk about the sorts of things that they see the future is. So, the future of networking. Today, I'm joined by Martin Casado. You all know him as heavily involved in NSX, but I'll let him tell the audience a little bit about himself.
So I actually started in distributed computing a while back. My first job was working in the national labs, and then during 9/11, the priorities of the national labs changed. I went to intelligence, where I did network security. So this is from 2001 to 2004, so Afghanistan through Iraq war. I was in network security, and so I got interested in that. I didn't have a background in networking or security, and so I went to Stanford, ended up getting my PhD there, and I was part of the original research team at Stanford that worked on what became SDN. Then I wrote the first draft of OpenFlow in about 2007, and that kind of took off on its own trajectory. I started a company called Nasira, did that for 5 years. That was acquired by VMware 3 years ago, and now I run the networking and security business unit at VMware. So kind of a crooked path I carved to get here.
I think crooked paths are the best paths.
I do too.
I'm not sure that I look back. Like, you were at you were working for security during the Iraq war, and I was backpacking and getting drunk as I went through Syria and Jordan.
Fair enough, perfect.
So, and look where we ended up. You're in charge of a $1 billion business unit at VMware, and I'm sitting here in a bathrobe.
Listen, I'm in my pajamas too, so I'm not sure we went that far different.
Let's talk about the future of networking. You are, you know, obviously key part of the NSX strategy, and that overlay networking has sort of been forged ahead. What's the future of that? One of the things that I'm seeing is a drive from some of the other vendors and a lot of the IETF and the standards bodies to drive into how packets should flow in the network. So this idea of an intelligent network. But I also had much more of an idea that the future of, say, networking, be it SD-WAN, be it internet, would always be over the top. Do you think there's going to be a combination of over the top protocols as well as in the network? So things like network services headers or named data networking, or are we looking at both or an exclusive one way or the other?
Yeah, you know, I think that due to the history and evolution of the industry, we're taking something that's relatively complex and we've made it relatively simple and made it awfully complex. And so let me describe what I mean by that, which is I actually think the networking problem is relatively straightforward, and there are a number of great solutions for it. Let me focus on the data center just to start off with. I mean, the problem that the network should provide in the data center is the ability to move a packet between two points in a complex graph in a way that'll efficiently use the existing physical infrastructure. You know, and this is something, for example, L3 networks can do really well. They can move packets between any two points. If you turn on things like multipathing, they can do it in inefficient ways. If you can adequately mark your packets, you can do it in ways so that big flows don't provide latency delays to small flows and so forth. So we understand all of that. So, and that is a technical problem that you need specialized hardware for, because you need a parallel lookup if you have high port density, and the industry has very well.
Let me try and summarize that. So you're pointing out that in the data center you have a graph or thousands of computers, and they're endpoints to endpoints. And we talk to the network itself is invisible to the endpoints. They just send a packet and the network transports it. So end-to-end connectivity or point to point, it's across the network. We can do things in the network like load balancing over multiple links or pathing, but we don't fundamentally get involved. There's no connection between the endpoint and the network itself.
That's exactly right. So then you're like, okay, so what is the job of the network? The way I like to think of it, I think actually all of the discipline of networking, say, okay, imagine you have one really big box, or like say one of those like 1950s phone switches, you know the pictures, right? With
the
wires.
Class 5 switches, ESS, yeah.
You know, you've got a big box with a whole bunch of holes in it, and you want to put a packet in one hole and it's going to pop out another hole, and you want to do that efficiently. That, to me, is the networking problem. And that, I believe, the industry has solved many times over with just basic say, L3 connectivity, just basic IP connectivity. So everything else to me is not a networking problem anymore. As soon as you get above that, things like where data lies, load balancing at a session level, even broadcast and multicast, I think all of these things, with maybe the exception of broadcast and multicast, can be implemented as part of an application or as part of a compute node.
They're a software problem, if you will.
They're not only a software problem, I also think that they're an application problem, which is the closer you are to the application, the more semantics you have for things like discovery, things like load balancing, caching, all of that. You have, if you're part of the application, you have much, much deeper semantics, and you don't have to guess at things. And so,
About metadata there. So if this data comes from this server to that server in the data center, that server might be running MySQL, and this is my middleware, and it's part of this security domain because it's in this Windows Active Directory group, and it's defined its security policy. You've got access to all that metadata on a server, but the network doesn't. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, that's it. So an application knows what it's doing by and large. It knows that this is data that it wants to cache, or it knows that this is a request that it wants to load balance, or it knows potentially where the nodes are to discover new nodes, right? And many of these things we've tried to do in the network at the past. We've tried to do session-level load balancing. We've tried to do discovery. I mean, early protocols would use like actual physical broadcasting for discovery. That's where you get things like Rendezvous and NetBuoy. But the reality is the application knows so much more about this. And so when I think about the future, I actually think about how Gen 3 data centers have evolved. And by Gen 3, I mean like new build outs of data centers. And if you see these, let's say, Tencent or Baidu or, any of the kind of these new mega data centers, what they do is they build very, very simple physical L3 networks. And then everything else is in the application. There's no overlay. There's no L2 service model. There's no network services. It's basically the job of the network now is passing packets, and the application has consumed everything else. But I actually think that that's an end state. I think that's where we should be trying to get to.
So you would see the devices as being high speed, low latency, simple as possible, the hardware devices being as simplified as software as possible. And following along that line, this is where the Google data center and, those published research papers says, if our devices are the simplest and, have the smallest number of features we need to achieve the task, then they don't get in our way. The network is reliable, stable, and then I can run load balancers in, Nginx instances, or I can run virtual machines if I want. Vendor supported instances of load balancers. That's the sort of model you see.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say, what characteristics would I give to a physical network? I'd say, it's got to be high port density. So as many 10 gig ports as you can cram into some physical area. B, you want to have unified latency between any two ports, so you can treat it like a general resource. So you don't want to send a packet, and depending on the path, it would have wildly different latency, because that will actually constrain the application. C, I do think that there are separate service models you want to provide the application. The ones that tend to the most practical are a high throughput type service model and a low latency type service model. So that way applications that want to do super high throughput workload can, and those that have very small transactions can. And I think that's it. And by the way, it's very easy to make the argument that this has to be a special purpose piece of hardware, because the only way we know how to do this very quickly is to look up a whole bunch of rules in parallel, which is why you have special memory in switches called CAMs. If I say, okay, the problem of networking, I'm going to reduce it down to boxes with holes. You put packets in one hole, they pop out another hole. That you say, yes, that requires specialized hardware and certain sets of algorithms to make sure it's efficient, and that's the networking problem. And I would argue that everything else, you can make very strong arguments of why it should be at the edge. And then I would no longer call that the networking problem. I'd call it an application problem.
What you're saying is networking is about connecting devices together. I connect this to the network, give me connectivity. Services are something that's best done at the application layer.
That's exactly right. And I would say the problem is networking is moving a packet between any two points in a complex graph as efficiently as possible and with the service model demanded. And that's it. That's to me the networking problem.
I agree with that in principle. I mean, that's the way the internet is working today. We provide everybody a connection to the internet. We get the connectivity. However, we're talking about scaling up data centers to unbelievably large sizes.
Right.
We're talking about moving greater and greater volumes of data around. There is a case from some people saying that what we need to be able to do is make the network intelligent so we can bring the data to where the person is. Or I can actively intervene in the data flow to be able to optimize it in some way or enhance it.
Yeah, so again, if we focus on the data center, when it comes to bringing data closer to people, for example, in my view, absolutely you want to do things like intelligent caching. But now this becomes a distributed systems problem. So different data is going to have different consistency requirements, right? Some of it, it doesn't matter if you lose it in transit. Other, you're going to have to make sure that you update it totally. And when it comes to data and data consistency, I mean, this is very much an application level issue. Different applications have different consistency issues. And if you have different points in the consistency design space, let's say you have some data you want to be eventually consistent and other data to be strongly consistent, like what point in the design space you choose is going to greatly impact scalability. So I think that the only layer that actually has the intelligence to determine how to handle this and what the right trade-offs are is the application, because it has that knowledge of what the data is.
Okay. So if those applications are communicating together, let's say they're memcache instances, for example, which are doing, you know, application request caching or some other type of, you know, intervention, transparently redirecting for accounting purposes or things like that.
Yeah.
Does the network need to know about that? Is there some way that the network hardware needs to be signaled to say, make this do this? This data session has this metadata associated with it. If you see it, do this to it. Should the network act on it, or should the application just send it to the right point right from the beginning?
It was certainly in the data center, the network should not be involved, because A, it is such a disadvantage to say anything about data anyways, right? I mean, it doesn't understand, you know, for example, things like consistency requirement. It doesn't understand where the data needs to live or how long it needs to live. And applications have point-to-point addressability. So applications can get it anywhere it needs to go just by saying, well, it needs to go here or there. The only thing that the network can affect is not where it goes, but how it gets there. I mean, this is something that, you know, of course that you need between caches. But I don't know. If you look at the WAN, all of a sudden the picture changes a little bit. In the WAN, and again, I don't think that it should be involved in anything where it acknowledges or looks at data, because it doesn't have that context. But the WAN can provide service, you know, different service differentiation or different paths. And that's where taking smart paths may make sense, because, you know, the cost of high bandwidth links can be very, very high. So now you can actually optimize over a global phenomenon. But again, I wouldn't say that the network actually looks and understands that data. It's still just moving packets between any two points in a complex graph and nothing more.
And I guess the other challenge is as applications change. Like, for example, we're going through the transition from IPv4 to IPv6. We're also seeing transitions from HTTP 1.1 to HTTP 2. We're seeing consistent transitions around encryption. Like, for example, SHA-256 is regarded now as obsolete, and it will be easily crackable by 2016, so you need to start upgrading. If the applications themselves are going to, you know, what the network can see is the packet formats. It has to recognize packet formats to be engaged or to be integrated. But if the packet formats are going to change regularly and often, how do you keep changing the network at speed is partly a concern.
Yeah, and I think this brings up a very, very good point. So let's assume in 4 years, all networking, both WAN and data center, are just L3 networks. And then we decide, you know, many applications need intelligent caching to improve user response latencies, to reduce the cost of data transmission, et cetera, you know, for basic performance. We said, well, in order to do that, we know how to do caching. You basically run caching on x86. So we're going to litter a bunch of x86 boxes through the WAN, just like you do with CDNs today. And then the question is, who do you expose that API to? Is that something that you give to network operators? Is it something that you do totally transparently? Or is it an API that you provide to application developers to use intelligently? I think it's incredibly easy to make the argument that that third option of providing an API to application developers that do understand the data, they do understand the consistency requirements, they do understand the constraints they're working in, is the right layer. So again, I do think that as soon as you get away from moving packets between point A and point B in a complex graph, I think that's when then it becomes an application problem. And that's not what we've done in the past.
The challenge there, of course, is that developers aren't going to look to the network for APIs. They're busy writing their software. Why would they pull an API from the network?
Totally agree, which is why it's so interesting to look at how applications are evolving in the cloud. From the perspective of an app developer, they use APIs for, you know, storing and moving data. I mean, you got distributed data structures, you know, like, you know, DHTs is now a dated example, but many distributed data structures, whether they're kind of a NoSQL store where you're putting data and you're accessing in a distributed way. I mean, modern distributed systems do a lot of the things that we think networking's do. They do distribute data. They do discovery. They do load balancing. And so more and more APIs, especially modern APIs in the cloud, do already consume networking. And that's what people are building against. And you know, as those become more sophisticated and the clouds continue to grow, clearly things like AWS are enormous. I think that the applications already have done this. I mean, I think that there's a set of applications you can argue that just use the network as transport.
So what you're implying there is there are public clouds out there like Google, AWS, Azure, and right. Developers are now saying, I need to dynamically create a DNS instance. I call the API, it creates a DNS instance. I need a load balancer. They call an API and literally a load balancer appears in those services. And this is then building a new generation of developers' awareness of networking, which creates a positive reinforcement cycle where all of a sudden having APIs in the network will work where it never has in the last 30 years. Is that a fair summary?
Well, so I'm saying something a little bit differently, which is, in these modern clouds, the networking moves up a layer to another layer of abstraction. So these guys don't actually worry about DNS, and they don't even really think about a load balancer in the same way that we think about a load balancer. It's all part of the application logic. And so while those may be, there may be a DNS name server spinning up or something, they actually operate at higher level name. So whatever the application specific name for the data is, or the application specific name for the user is. And so, I mean, I think that the whole thing is moving up a layer. I mean, I would say that DNS, like IP address management, is actually part of the networking problem, which is how do you get a packet between point A and point B? But that can be relatively static.
Yeah.
And then everything else is actually consumed by the application. And things that we've traditionally thought are network problems that network administrators or operators have to manage, things like DNS, things like LDAP, things like DHCP, things like load balancers, all of that just becomes application libraries that are consumed at a much higher level.
So this comes down to the discussion I brought up on other podcasts where we talk about the difference between tagging and flow mapping. That is where today what we use is protocols like MPLS. We put a tag and then the network decides how to route that tagged data through the network. The network does the parthing, but it also allows the tag to extrapolate metadata. We use protocols like BGP to say this tag has these properties, this QoS, this idea. And we see standards initiatives getting on board to start creating using things like path computational element protocols and network services headers to be able to extend the concept of tags so that the network can get involved and take packets apart and do things with them, take the data flow apart. Whereas OpenFlow, which is the project that you were in, just says there's a two endpoints in connectivity, map a flow in this device and just let it get across as fast as possible. That seems to be a collision point in the market where on one hand, we have this tagging network is active versus this straight out, just map a path through the device and cut it through. Is that fair?
So OpenFlow has evolved a lot. And actually, we wrote a paper that I can send you a reference to that basically tries to reconcile OpenFlow with a tagged architecture. Because my personal opinion these days is, I mean, what OpenFlow is just trying to say is, you know, you want to set forwarding rules. And that could be by looking up tags or, setting tags or whatever. But you want to have like some remote way of programming that. And so you could use OpenFlow for just doing L3, or you could do OpenFlow as an MPLS control plane. So it's compatible with all of those. You know, so I believe that the networking problem, like I said before, is moving a packet between point A and point B in a complex graph. That's the networking problem. And then within that, I think that actually different types of networks should use different types of algorithms and protocols to get that done. I think something in the data center, you can just use multipathing. You can use ECMP, and you don't have to do anything intelligent at all. Now, I do think that the problem still is moving a packet between point A and point B in a complex graph. There's no need to tag. There's no need to do any of that because that, the application layer can add its own metadata as it wants, and they can just treat the data center as an end-to-end point. When it comes to the backbone, then all of a sudden I don't think L3 is the right model because you do want to be able to label independent flows and route them in separate paths. And this is where something like MPLS actually makes a lot more sense for traffic engineering. And so I think it was Scott Shankar-Tame and I, what we posit in the paper is if you're sending packets, for example, on the WAN where transport bandwidths are very expensive, a tagging architecture makes a lot of sense. If you're doing it on an edge where you just want to scale and you have unified bandwidth, then something like destination-based forwarding with prefix summarization makes the most sense. But again, all of networking is just providing a path between point A and point B in a complex graph. It's not doing anything more, which is I would not talk about evolving packet headers per se, unless it's to just pass information between endpoints.
So the flip side of this is, if you think about what's happening in carrier networks with their points of presence, and they're talking about virtualizing all of the, at the bottom of a mobile phone tower, there will be a data center of sorts. You know, it might be just a couple of racks. It could be 30 or 40 racks worth of gear. And inside of there, they'll run these VRANs, virtual radio access networks, and vCPEs, customer premises equipment, where there are many VMs. And to make that run, they're talking about this idea of service chaining or NFV-type activities. And there is a case being made in the standards bodies that the best way to be able to do service chaining is to actually use a tagged frame so that a packet can be chained, you know, dynamically where it needs to be. Does that Sure. resonate with you?
Yeah, so if you're talking about, okay, you've got an existing set of legacy services, and they don't know how to self-organize, and they were never developed in a broader framework. They're developed at point solutions. Then you need some other mechanism for, you know, creating a path out of them, or you need some other mechanism for determining putting them on a route. So I think if you look far enough into the future and you're saying actually applications know how, so what are you running in these VMs? Generally you're running, you know, network services, VMs, the only thing we really know how to virtualize is x86. Yeah. So it's a VM running on x86. So you virtualized compute somehow. So I would say that compute should be application logic. And in the future, this should all be part of the application. And so these data centers with VMs, what's exposed is an API that the application uses. And it's no longer a networking problem at all. And the network just gets busy back to what I think it should be doing, is providing packets between point A and point B. Clearly, there's a massive transition period where, in order to provide network services that the application isn't even aware of, for example, you know, caching or IDS, IPS, what the application isn't aware of, you need some plumbing, some mechanism in order to do that.
Yeah. You could. So you're talking about radio servers there, for example. The most common application in a mobile phone tower is when a person comes in and connects to the network, they hit a diameter, which is the iteration of radius, and authenticate that user. But radius itself doesn't lend itself to cloud-based applications. The query is not an API. It's a request going to a specific IP.
Many of these things have come out of, you know, these very, very legacy protocols, which is fine. Of course, we're going to evolve. But I would say definitely applications today understand notions of users. And so maybe that there is some, for example, authentication of device has to do with a radio tower, but everything above that, anything, you know, even on the security domain or whatever, this can be very much a compute problem. And once you moved it into compute and you turn it into a distributed system, you move it into the application layer, I don't think you need to modify network protocols. The protocols, network protocols do what they're good at, is moving the packets between compute nodes. When you start doing things like service chains or source routes, now the network is aware of the path a packet needs to take. And so if, for example, the application decides that the service change is different, you know, it's going to have to invalidate something that's in the network, or it's going to have to communicate with a network. And I think that in general, these approaches haven't worked. And I think that actually just the network exposing point to point is the most general solution as we evolve our applications.
So I can see how that you can make that argument. One point that was made to me about that is that, you know, with the arrival of Internet of Things, you're talking about billions. We can argue about how many, depending on which IoT consultancy you're talking to, but many billions of new devices coming onto the Internet.
Right.
Is there a scaling problem with point-to-point? Like, do we have enough bandwidth to allow that to happen? It's like one of the things that I believe is that hybrid cloud is a highly unlikely thing to happen at any substantial scale because there's simply not enough bandwidth in the world to allow VMs to dynamically migrate over the backbones. Does that also apply to IoT? Are there scaling problems there with point to point?
Well, I think IoT is actually another great example of exactly the discussion we're having. So, I mean, what is IoT? To me, it's two things. One of them, it's a saying you've got tons of points, you know, millions of points, even in small geographic areas. And I think this is something that traditional protocols are very good at handling, right? I mean, like you could use, you know, IPv6 and we know how to scale to internet sizes because we've done this. And yes, you may have to create separate areas or whatever, but I think actually traditional networking is quite good at the scaling problem because it doesn't have to be strongly consistent. And especially if it doesn't have to do all of the stuff that we like to throw in enterprise networks, if it just has to move packets between point A and point B. But then you're like, okay, so now you just have traditional networking. What's so interesting about IoT? What's interesting about IoT is you're collecting all of this information. That information has to go somewhere and then be processed in a meaningful way. So I would argue that all of a sudden we're back to an application problem because that data is going to have different uses. Like maybe you're going to want to query that data in real time. Maybe you're just going to want to store the data. Maybe some data that you're collecting is a higher priority than others. Say if you're collecting information from a tractor, the danger data, you're going to want to process in a higher priority. So now this becomes a data transfer, database management, data consistency, distributed systems problem, which again, I think it's the application guys that have a much better way of doing it. And so, you know, I can see that
because I'm thinking of a farm, right? And if you've got a tractor rolling around and let's say you've got 50 sensors on the tractor collecting various pieces of data, if you're going to let the network do that, the question is, where is the application breaking? How do you troubleshoot that? So if I was to transport, the data back to the farm, the farmhouse where there's a data center built that caches the data, rolls it up before it ships it on to, you know, some public cloud over the internet, for example. Fair?
Yeah.
Maybe a network in the fields bringing the data back and then it's translated onto the internet. Or maybe they're connected on 3G. I don't know. Why would the network need to get involved that? Why not just send all the data away? Well, it could be that the cost of bit transport is high and therefore it's cheaper to do something locally. So to cache the data in the farmhouse or in a local data center and then do a data munge before you extract it out to a central point for processing and analytics. But you could do that in the application, as you're saying, or
right.
You could do it in the network. There's no right answer here.
Well, I guess that depends on what your definition of the network is, which is, to me, I would say the network's job is to get the packets to whatever compute nodes can do it the most efficiently by the route that's the most efficient. So even in the case that you said, that let's say that you've got, you know, in the farmhouse, in your grain silo, you've got a data center that things are very cheap, but it doesn't have a lot of capacity. And then you've got then you've got AWS. The choice on whether to do the computation in the grain tower or in AWS, I think that choice is also an application choice. So again, the network is just providing the packets to the grain tower where the application is deciding what to do. Hmm. Why is it the application? Well, the application is going to know what data that you want to compute locally and can and does require, say, higher latencies. And B, my guess is it's business logic and understanding of the macroeconomic situation that's going to inform the application here. So I just think it's a much richer interface for doing these things. And again, if I reduce the network just to moving packets between point A and point B in a complex graph, you can get it to the grain tower or you can get it to AWS. But it's the application that's driving that logic.
All right, I want to shift conversation now into virtual switches because I'm sure this is a topic near and dear to your heart, right?
Very.
So in the last few weeks, we've seen, I recorded a show with PlumGrid around their iovisor virtual switch. We've seen Project Calico come up. Yeah. We've got Open vSwitch, of course, which you're heavily involved with. And then we've got a range of other proprietary vSwitches all around there. Is this a good thing for the ecosystem to have all of these different virtual switches, or should we be focusing down on just, you know, a consistent, predictable, just let one survive the transition? Do you have some thoughts there?
Well, I mean, I love times of chaos because they generally precede, you know, maturation of areas. And I think in kind of, you know, market category creation, and periods where you're seeing tons of innovation, tons of chaos, tons of energy, you always have balkanization in many approaches. And I really applaud that. I honestly do. I think that we've learned so much in the last, you know, when, let's see, we started Open vSwitch probably 6 years ago. And things have evolved so much since then. And I think that all of these approaches do contribute to the discourse, to the dialogue. And they start, you know, it's interesting. They all start to kind of borrow from each other, and we get to learn from each other. I think naturally over time, markets will pick, you know, the winner. And I do think having more to choose from is going to create a better outcome. And so I think that because we're still kind of in this area of chaos, I think it's good to have multiple. And I think naturally, I don't think there's any concern that, you know, this isn't going to somehow converge into smaller sets. And it may be that you want different solutions for different points in the design space. So it may be that you will end up with a few and not just one, but I do think that we'll have less to deal with in the future.
I don't think we can support all three, or we can't support a vast number of choices. I don't think there's enough will in the industry to support a huge variety of choices when it comes to the virtual switch space.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that we kind of over-focus on the specifics of the virtual switch. I mean, the virtual switch is supposed to be plumbing. Mm-hmm. And so I think as intelligence moves up to application layers and to PaaS layers, you know, the virtual switches themselves just become plumbing. It'll matter less that they exist there at all. I mean, it's not something that we interact with directly. And I think that will naturally cause convergence, because then it's just because, you know, it's a pain to troubleshoot different ones, which will cause us to all standardize on one. But I think, you know,
yeah, because I think that's where I'm headed, is like, you know, on a 5 to 10 year horizon, we can't have five different ways to configure virtual switches. We need to simplify it down to just one. I think the history of the market shows that networking actually isn't that important in the overall scheme of things, unlike programming languages, where we can have easily 40 or 50 different languages and they can all survive. Networking converged on just one CLI. And now we're seeing it going through, as you say, this time of change where things, you know, there's disruption, but ultimately things mature. I'm concerned that we've got a lot of virtual switches, and some of them are actually radically different from the others. Like Project Calico is decidedly weird. It uses BGP to configure itself. You know, they just don't make sense from an API or an application perspective, I think.
Yeah, well, so I agree, which is you definitely want uniformity, especially when it comes to debugging, but also, you know, whatever function is being exposed, so that you know an application is portable between different environments. The good news is, you know, virtual switches are, in many cases, exposing traditional interfaces like, you know, L2 and L3, et cetera. And so they do have some base level of compatibility with existing applications. But, you know, a lot of these have operational extensions of, like, how do you manage things like ACLs? How do you do things like state mobility if you're doing, like, flow tracking? You know, if they don't support the same types of features, then, you know, it could limit what applications you run on top of them. And so I do agree with you. Over time, we're going to see a convergence just naturally, because that's what people want. But I do think it's great to have a period of time where people are trying so many different things, so we're sure that we're actually exploring the full technical space.
Yeah, I agree. So this, as you say, lots of open source activity lets us explore different options, and ultimately it comes down. Again, I want to change topics. I think that we've probably taken that one as far as it's going to go, to talk about white box, white brand, and merchant silicon in the networking. I know that NSX and VMware have been very quick to jump onto a range of different networking vendors and to partner with all the players. Have you got any comments on how you see this market playing out over the next 5 to 10 years? Do you think we're all going to be using merchant silicon and white box in the years to come, or is it going to be a much more diverse ecosystem?
Well, I think that merchant silicon almost certainly, when it comes to the economies of scale. I mean, Broadcom, for example, and there's a number of companies that make switching chips. I mean, that's all they do. They've got full teams that they just work on building the next generation switches. That's the full competency of the company. And
those just build silicon too. That's all they build. And the fact that they build a switch chip is almost, it's just another silicon thing.
Exactly right. I mean, this is their expertise, is ASIC design. and they build all sorts of chips. And then they've got so many different routes to market for these chips. I mean, many different customers. So just the economy scales of the multiple consumers of this and the expertise, I think, means that over time, merchant silicon is almost certainly going to be this. And we've seen this happen. This has already happened at the top of rack. And I think over, you know, if you compare 10 years ago to now, I think that this trend is very, very clear. When it actually comes to the switch supply chain, I think that's actually less clear what's going to happen in the future. I mean, I've been watching this market very closely, and I think things like incumbency, support model, channel dynamic, who owns the channel, ability to cannibalize, all of these things are coming into play as opposed to maintaining presence. And because switching is only, at least in the data center, only about 10% of the total CapEx spend, I don't see the same dynamic playing out that we saw during the PC era. And so my guess is that you're still going to, I think the mix is going to change a bit, but I think that you're going to see the traditional vendors still maintain huge market share, except for the cost models are going to shift somewhat, more towards software. I think the hardware is less something to charge on, and it's going to become more a software and services game. But I do think that the traditional vendors are still going to be around. The white box model, it's very difficult to see this because of the channel problem taking off significantly, and because the costs are just not that compelling.
So you're saying the price of vendor-branded models of all the various types, whatever they are, so we'll most likely see switches with merchant silicon predominantly, and yes, then ultimately they'll buy them from their traditional vendors just like they do today. That seems the most likely, but anything could happen as the market changes.
Yeah, so that's right. So
I don't get out there easily enough.
Well, I think the high-level point is I don't think that this is going to play out the same way that PCs played out, and I think it's kind of folly to make that analogy. Mm-hmm. I do believe that because of traditional vendors' willingness to cannibalize themselves, the fact that everybody's working on merchant silicon, it seems that they're adopting that. That it's not clear what things are going to look like as far as who you're going to buy your switches from in the future. I do think it's safe to say it's going to be merchant silicon. I think that's very safe to say.
Yeah, I think the market will be predominantly merchant within just a few years. It doesn't make sense, especially at the mid market. But I also think that custom silicon will still play a part at certain niche markets like carrier and service provider backbones.
Sure, fair enough.
But even merchant silicon will affect down at the low end. Virtualization is continuing to change everything. We're seeing the rise of x86 for network appliances. So today, where we run firewalls on custom hardware, when I say custom, I'm using air quotes over this side because 9 times out of 10, they're actually x86 motherboards.
Yeah, I know.
Just Checkpoint, Fortinet, F5, they're all just Intel x86 motherboards under their hard hood with a silicon chip wired into them quite often that has 20 or 48 ports of Ethernet, and that's merchant silicon today. Yeah. Do you think that customers are going to move to this rapidly, or is it going to be a long, slow haul?
I think this depends largely on the customer. One of the things I think is one of the most interesting questions at this macro scale around this is the application basically going to get ahead of the operators and just not wait? And so there's kind of a race that's going on. One thing is you can take all of these traditional appliances, you can move them into VMs, and then you can automate them and you can orchestrate them in a way that everything's very quick. And this is what I work on, is to help people do this. And this is definitely happening, right? A lot of people are moving these things into VM, and they're using automated provisioning systems like OpenStack or VRA or whatever to provision them. And so they're automating everything. The L4 through 7 is running it in virtual machines, but you still have kind of the traditional services. Yeah. And at the same time, you've got this kind of much bigger movement that's going on where applications are just moving into the cloud, and they're being totally rewritten not to require the traditional services in the same way. And I think both of these trends are happening actually fairly quickly. So, in the future, in 5 years in the future, I mean, I think for any given enterprise, say, I think it's reasonable to ask the question, are you going to be running your own sets of network services for your own applications, in which case they better be in VMs to be compatible, or are you just going to go to www.salesforce.com and that's basically your application? And if it's the latter, I would say that the application now has consumed pretty much the network services, and it's just something that you get like a utility, right? It's something that you get as a service.
I'm just wondering how fast it will come. Like for me, the ability to use firewalls as a network appliance, there's two things. One is you've got to get away from the concept of multi-gigabit firewall capacity or device capacity and get around to using 20 instead of one big one, and that'll increase reliability. I think the second thing that I like about network appliances is the ability to keep turning up the horsepower. So you could start off with a VM that has one vCPU and 256 gigs of RAM, and you can keep adding CPUs and memory and networking performance to that capability, or even have multiple instances to grow. So instead of having this bottleneck of one appliance at the top of your data center, you can actually scale horizontally instead of having to scale vertically. And that, to me, is one key thing. But the biggest thing is the visibility. Once a device is in a VM, I actually have a whole bunch of new ways to see how much horsepower is this thing using. Instead of relying on an SNMP to give me CPU or memory consumption, I can go to the VM and see how many CPU cycles the device is burning and start to predict how much growth, how much capacity planning changes drastically for me.
Yeah, so actually, I mean, this is one of the biggest trends that certainly I see. I mean, some of our L4 through 7 partners, over 50% of the appliances they ship now are in virtual form factors. And so this trend is definitely happening. I mean, one of the big advantages of this trend is basically if you run it on a VM, you can co-locate it with a compute node. And if you co-locate it with a compute node, you can get access to east-west traffic, which is an insanely difficult thing to do with traditional appliances. I mean, if you just think about bandwidth differences, right? If you look at a data center, the north-south border is what? I mean, I don't know, 100 gigabits per second if you're like the biggest data center ever.
If you're a normal enterprise data center, your north-south is usually 1 to 4 gigs.
That's right. And now what is the cross-sectional bandwidth of a single top of rack switch? It's a terabit, right? You've got 48 ports of 10 gig down and 240s up, right? So the difference in bandwidth capacity, east-west traffic has, you know, terabits, often tens of terabits, where the north-south one is, you know, 10 to 100 gigabits. And so if you actually want to apply a service like, say, firewalling to east-west traffic, the technical problem is you want to now apply filtering to tens of terabits of potential capacity. And for that, the approach that makes the most sense to me is, well, you can distribute it along the edge, co-located with the compute node, so that you've taken that 10 terabits and reduced it down to independent 10 gig chunks, one for each compute port. And now you can actually do this viably. And putting them in VMs is a great approach to doing that.
So let's change topics to one of my favorite unicorns to ride around a normal Packet Pushers podcast, which is IP multicast. I generally think that the complexity of IP multicast in networking devices exceeds the value that we can derive out of it as something useful. So now I've talked about this with other people on other shows, so I wanted to get your opinion on, do you think IP multicast has a long-term future, or is it something that, as we move to these new, you know, software-based architectures you're talking about, is it something that's going to sunset? What's your view?
Yeah, so Greg, I totally agree with you that I think that, you know, IP multicast in the network outside of like pretty niche use cases is not worth the complexity. And again, it's another example, and I keep going back to this, but I think it's true, of something where the application can just do a much better job. So the application will know who's part of a group, what service level they want as part of that group. The application knows this. The application will know what type of data to send to everybody and what type not to send to everybody. And we've shown that N-system multicast in certain environments works just fine, in which case I would say this becomes an application problem and it becomes responsible for communicating from point to multiple points. And then it's no longer something we've got to worry about in the network. So I think it's a great example of something that will, I think, over time go away and move into the application. And in many cases already has.
Yeah, I believe that we're sort of at the point where once upon a time bit transport or bandwidth was so expensive that it made sense to use IP multicast. And as time gone by, the bandwidth is now readily available. Overall, it's cheaper just to use point-to-point or anycast to achieve the same outcomes in some ways. Or, I mean, even content delivery networks. I read a research article about a content delivery network. They don't use multicast to distribute traffic between CDN nodes because it's cheaper and easier just to use anycast and send it point-to-point to every node in the network.
Yep.
So no, I'm not 100% sure. And sure, I know people out there have multicast networks today, and I'm sure they're doing something useful and valuable. But I don't think that in 5 to 10 years' time that IP multicast will be as prominent as it is today.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think like a capstone point on this entire conversation is that, listen, if you build really robust networks that can send packets between any two points in a unidirectional graph with some service model, I think that you've kind of nailed the networking problem. And then on top of that, the applications can treat data however they want to move data wherever they want.
Same thing with QoS. Any perspectives there?
I mean, for me, cost is always reduced to the following problem statement. If you want to have a service level that's guaranteed, you need to have a queue. So you have to have a queue per service level that's meaningful. So if you want to have, and this is an end-to-end queue in the network. So if you want to have, you know, 1,000 tenants, each with their own service level, you're going to have 1,000 queues in the network. In my experience, in practice, instead of doing that, trying to provide a service level per thing, per user, per object, it's better to just say, listen, there's two types of networks we like to build. We like to build networks that are high throughput, and we like to build networks that are low latency, and they've got different buffering requirements. And so I think like 2 or 3 QoS levels is certainly sufficient. Merchant Silicon has this today. We know how to mark these using traditional markings on the outside of the packets. So I think that the problem is more of how do you mark the packets? Like, how do you know if something's an elephant, like a high bandwidth, or something is low latency?
You're not going to do that in silicon. There's no way to extrapolate application state or metadata or intent in the silicon itself. It has to be done at some other point. And tagging it hasn't worked yet, and it's not going to scale up to tomorrow is sort of my current perspective. I'm open-minded, and I'm asking everybody how can QoS scale, but I'm not sure that it ever can.
No, I totally agree. I do think it's very legitimate to say QoS level 1 is if you've got a high bandwidth flow, and QoS level 2 is if you have a low latency flow. That makes total sense, because that way, you know, you're not going to have the queuing delay on the low latency packets. But that's not providing like each flow or each user with their own guaranteed bandwidth. It's just saying that you've got two different buffering disciplines, basically. That makes a lot of sense to me. But then the trick is how do you know whether a flow needs high latency or high throughput? Well, the only thing that really knows that is the application at the end of the day. So again, we go back to an application problem, which is marking these packets correctly.
Well, I want to thank Martin Casado for dragging himself out of bed at an ungodly hour in Silicon Valley and joining us today. Martin, where can people find you on the internet?
I guess Google search Martin Casado and they'll see it.
You can also find him every now and then. He appears on Twitter with some oructations around various topics on the internet at @Martin_Casado. That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Please make sure you come back. You can join in the discussion by leaving comments on the show notes that accompany the publication of this podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show. You can send us email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Check out the podcast website, where there's a range of really interesting content and on today's show, or follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers. But as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.